So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
I am one who is cute like Panda. I'm in danger. Help me, save me. Ha ha! Trick you! Because I am fast like dragon! I am fortune cookie. An Asian.
Yeah? Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I'm Beirut, the mad bomber. I will destroy your American way of living.
You know what? Let's add the gun back in.
So expected.
I'm Scab, and I'm your worst nightmare. I'll gut your Gucci and blast your Beamer. Die, yuppie scum!
Hi, I'm Melrose. I am a bad, bad girl who likes to party, party, party. And Daddy's been a bad, bad boy. Oh, come here, Daddy.
Y'all stupid for going to work every day and paying taxes. I let the government pay for all my shit, and I lives like a queen, a welfare queen.
Men walk in fear through these city streets. For it is there you may meet me. And though I am only moderately attractive, I am desperate. And there's nothing more dangerous than a desperate woman. And there is no woman more desperate than the homewrecker.
It's not working.
Yeah.
Did you want me to push it further, or...
No, it's just, I don't know, the whole thing's...
Yeah, it's like, I mean, who is she?
Yeah, yeah. Help us out, Ruth. Who do you think you are?
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock alongside Wei Ting.
Yeah, we're here.
We're here. Happy Friday.
Thanks.
End of a long week.
Mm-hmm. I know. So, how have you been?
I've been well.
Yeah?
I'm ready to chat about GLOW.
Oh, okay.
Is that what you're ready to talk about? I hope so. Did we have our shows mixed up?
No, this is it. Did you just want to get into it right away?
No, we don't have to at all. Is there things on your mind?
No, not really.
Oh. What are you drinking?
This is coffee. Yes.
Just coffee? Normal
just
coffee?
Just coffee.
I thought you were trying to distance yourself from coffee.
I am, except for these shows. You know, I kind of need it once in a while just to perk me up. I notice a real difference. Do you notice a difference? Actually, I'm curious.
I notice a difference for you.
Can you tell when I'm on the coffee?
When you're on the coffee. Yeah. When you're on the cough. I definitely sense you and I think, are at our lowest when we both come in Monday night for like the 10 minutes before we start Review a Raw.
Actually, that's when I'm at my most awake, I feel.
I don't sense it. Oh.
No, usually.
I feel you're most energetic for these Review Away shows, actually.
Okay. I think for those is because, like, ever since we started to do the video, I've had, like, to worry about the video.
Yeah, you have multiple things to do.
So at that point, I'm just kind of, like, focused on, like, just doing it, you know, getting it done. Maybe that's why I'm not that talkative.
I'm not talkative either when I come in on Monday.
You're not at all.
No.
Yeah. But I sense that because you've had a long day and you're very tired.
Yeah. And you, what are we going to talk about? Hey.
No, nothing.
If we mention anything about Raw, like, what's the point of doing that before the show?
You're right.
None.
I like doing these Review Away shows only with audio. I feel like we're able to do them a lot more relaxed, you know? You kind of like introducing video to it, just kind of sometimes just
like people are watching.
Yeah, but also just like the technical thing, especially in that room with the hockey sticks. It's
brutal.
Yeah. Anyway.
No hockey sticks in here.
Nope. Just two mics and a laptop.
So this series, are you ready to bridge ourselves slowly into this?
I think so.
This is going to be a much more wide kind of view of the show. We're not going episode by episode, line by line. I have outlined several of the themes and stories and characters that I enjoyed or didn't enjoy. We're going
to
find out.
It would take way too long to go episode by episode. I don't think anybody would want to sit through that.
Okay. I don't know if this is going to slightly turn into a bit of an interview, but I might just default to interviewing you about this show. But
I actually took no notes. For once, I wanted to just sit back and enjoy it like I would enjoy any Netflix series.
I kind of regretted taking notes. I took too many. This is a series I would say, if I have some downtime over the summer, I would like to rewatch this series. Mm-hmm. Because I took, first of all, I got screeners sent to me a number of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And so I'm watching them on my laptop, and I'm not a big fan of having to take my notes in a minimized Microsoft Word while I've got the screen up and the text is over top half the screen. So I took longhand notes.
You did handwritten notes.
Handwritten notes. What did I say? Longhand? Yeah. Is that the proper term?
I don't know.
Longhand.
There's
shorthand.
So maybe that's shorthand.
Yeah, that's probably what I was thinking.
So their notes. Why do they call it shorthand?
I don't know. I've never used that term in my life.
Is it because like people with smaller hands would tend to take smaller notes?
Yeah, Donald Trump hands. So I took so many notes because I feel whenever we're away from wrestling, I think I overcompensate with notes because I know this is not your traditional just blah, 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 hold sequences. Right.
We typically have a format when we do actual wrestling shows where we go match by match, talk about the match itself, give us your, you know, like we talk about our thoughts and we move on. It's very kind of linear.
Yes.
These kind of documentaries and movies are slightly different.
I'm very prep heavy, as Wei may notice. Mm-hmm. I like to take lots of notes, but honestly, this show, I think I could have just jotted down some key quotes, some themes.
Absolutely.
And just call it in the ring with Wei.
Yeah.
As this show was. Kind of like Flair Steamboat used to do.
Oh.
So getting back to all of this, I had this show for quite a few weeks, so I had a bit more time than you to watch all of these episodes. And one of the things that worked for me very well, these shows capped off typically at the 30-minute mark, maybe a little over for some of the episodes. Mm-hmm. But I didn't even know what the length was going to be until we logged in. I thought maybe we were going to get hour-long episodes.
Me too.
These were much more digestible.
Yeah, I was expecting an hour-long show, and I was, I guess, expecting to spend 10 hours on this thing. But
we were not expecting to cover the entire series when we decided to review this. We were going to shoot for 5, and we both ended up watching the whole series.
In one night, I ended up watching, I think, 6 or 7 episodes. So it was actually a very easy watch to go through all 10.
Which Brandon Strode, recent guest on Keep It 2000, noted in one of his reviews that I read, all 10 episodes still shorter than WrestleMania.
Wow. Is that true? What is the total
10 minutes,
time?
10 episodes times 30 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Which is how much? 300 minutes?
300 minutes, which is still.
How much?
That's like 5 hours.
Two hours. Yeah, that's 5 hours. Wow. Yeah.
Is it 5 hours?
I think so.
No, it's not. It's more
60,
like
120, 240 is 4 hours, and then 300 is 5. Yes.
Perfect. That's why we are doing this line of work and not solving the world's algorithms.
That's why my parents are not very happy with me.
Or mine.
Oh, yes.
My father's an accountant.
Yes, right. Is your dad an accountant? I didn't know.
Yes.
I had no idea.
Yeah, he's been an accountant his
entire
life.
I thought
your
dad was a physician.
No. No, definitely not a Dr. Pollock in the family.
My mom. Oh, your dad is a lawyer. Your mom is a physician.
Oh, geez. I didn't see where you were going there. You jerk.
All you want from sexual education is a crazy-ass position, right?
Mad rhymes, Wei.
Anyway.
I always thought
some people will not get that. I imagine some people will just look up Glow Review on their iTunes or something, and they'll be hearing all this shit, and they'll be like, when is this – when are they going to talk about the actual show?
My hope is that Jenji Cohen somehow stumbles upon this podcast and hears us.
Who's that? She's the producer?
She's like the executive producer who this was pitched to, And
she's the boss.
I mean, her name was attached to this. And I mean, if Jenji Cohen pushes this, you're in good hands.
So let's give a context on the production itself. Cause, is she one of the producers of, Orange is the New Black?
Yes. She was, behind Weeds and Orange is the New Black.
I see.
So when you have hits like that, that is currency to just print money for and push your projects through, which, Liz Flahive and Carly Mensch were the two. They were executive producers on this show, and they saw the GLOW documentary on Netflix, and that kind of inspired this idea. They pitched it to Jenji Cohen, and she was on board, and that's kind of the creative brain trust behind this whole series. And Mensch and Flahive, they worked on Nurse Jackie together.
I see. Cool.
So that's kind of our structure of kind of the creators here. And just taking a look, I jotted some notes down here about the original GLOW series, which was created by David McLean, who left after two seasons. GLOW ran for four seasons from 1986 to 1990. If you've seen the documentary, which we have reviewed in the past, which nearly killed me, Matt Simber, he was the director that I think you can definitely take some loose and maybe not so loose connections to some of these characters. I think Matt Simber to
Mark Maron,
Sam Sylvia, Mark Maron's character, and even Sebastian to David McLean. So it ran for 104 episodes. They had some incredible syndication numbers. Just to, there was a graphic going around in 1988. They took out an ad. Right around the NATB convention, and they were doing a 14 share in New York, a 12 share in LA, 15 share in Seattle and Tacoma, a 10 share in Miami. So there was a time this was a really solid syndicated wrestling series, which their numbers would eventually decline. And the money man behind this, whose name I will butcher here, Meshulam Rickless, eventually just didn't want to fund this any longer, and GLOW fell apart, but we've seen all the different iterations of it. POW, we had Women of Wrestling, which David McLean is still attached to a WOW project that he is continuing to do with. But this is always – there have always been incarnations that originated with GLOW, and the documentary kind of developed this series.
Was he involved with the WrestleLicious as well, the most recent one?
David McLean, I don't think he was with WrestleLicious, but WrestleLicious was the exact same idea.
It had, like, all these reincarnations of GLOW seemed to have the same tone, you know? It's the same very campy tone. I think most of them had raps. So all kind of stemming from this initial, I guess, magic that they founded with GLOW.
So this series, I mean, going into it, Wei, what was kind of your expectation level? And this is before the reviews started to come out a couple of weeks ago. It certainly had major names behind, and then when the cast started to roll out, you had a lot of influential figures, I would say, that are attached to this. This was not going to be the pandemonium script, so to speak, for the Vince McMahon bio.
Well, knowing the I think the quality that Netflix has been able to produce since they've been doing original programming, I think my expectations were quite high. You know, knowing the names that were attached and the pedigree of the people that are involved with the project, I had pretty high expectations of a good, well-produced TV show. I also feel like in the public now, we're at a point, I guess we've been at a point for decades now where I think the public has a large understanding of what goes on behind the scenes in professional wrestling. And so a drama like this, I think is, you know, the public is more than ready for.
I think also having a show about women that is produced largely by women. Yeah. I think that was also something fresh for just a take on professional wrestling. And you had non-fans coming in to understand this world and what taking the very campy nature of GLOW and attaching, you know,
politics
to it.
Social
and
commentary.
Other themes to it, which maybe was not always the number one intent of the original GLOW, but it was a byproduct of it when you go back and look at some of the issues they were tackling at the time, as tongue-in-cheek as they were.
100%. I think the setting being in the 80s was also an immediate draw, you know, I think for anybody. Like, just to see the hairstyles, to see the music. We're still, like, I feel like the world is still very nostalgic for the 80s. You know what I mean? Not so much for the 90s.
I can't wait till we get to 90s nostalgia, like full on.
I don't think we've hit that. Like
somewhat.
Something about the 80s is just so far apart from, I think, where we are today. You know, the hairstyles, the pastel colors, the neon. It feels so different. Whereas I feel like the 90s aren't too far off from where we are today. Like you're wearing a hoodie. You know, I'm wearing flannel. You know what I mean?
These are 90s. Identifiers.
I feel like we're a lot closer to the 90s and we're a lot less nostalgic for the 90s than we are for the 80s still.
The boy band era stuff of the late 90s I associate with like we had some ridiculous fashion stuff in the 90s that I feel we get a bit of 90s nostalgia, but I still think we're a few years away from being full on 90s.
But of course, like Stranger Things was a huge hit last year for Netflix. And I think a big part of that success was the fact that they managed to create such an interesting, world with their style set in the 80s. And Glow, I think, is something that would probably take that to the next level.
One of the best parts about Netflix as well is that unlike if this were to be, they were to sign a deal with a network and introduce it, and three episodes in, it doesn't find its audience, and they haven't even shot the full season yet, and they're subject to network notes and changing this, changing that. Netflix, they give you your lump sum, produce us a season, you get to see it through. You're allowed to just go out there and do your season, and it either finds an audience or it doesn't, but you're at least given your vision to go out there and not be forced to make changes because numbers are not where they're supposed to be after three or four episodes, and it could be canceled after four episodes.
They play a lot more like long movies rather than network TV shows.
Yes. So some interesting notes here. Alison Brie had to go through four different auditions to get this role, and I'm sure at the end of this, outside of Marc Maron, I don't know if there's one person that's more irreplaceable than Alison Brie on this show. I mean, this is built around her and her character of Ruth as the main conflicted protagonist, if we want to.
I agree with that.
Yeah, she was outstanding on this. And the scene early on where Betty and Ruth have their first.
Sorry, by the way, are we doing spoilers?
Oh, I think we have to.
All right.
Yeah.
Spoiler warning, blah, 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 blah. Turn off now until you've seen the show.
I zero sympathy on this one. It's been out for a week.
Well, come on.
You can watch this in one sitting.
Yeah, but I have a lot more sympathy for people when it comes to Netflix shows because you're not expected. Same with movies, you know? It's not like wrestling or sporting events that have a real live component to them.
Well,
this is a
Glow Review podcast. Don't download it if you don't want to find out.
But there are a lot of reviews that are spoiler free.
Okay, so there will be tons of spoilers in this.
Okay, spoilers.
Announcement.
You've been warned
ahead of time. So not going in any particular order. Let's talk about some of the characters, the ones that you enjoyed. Yeah. I would put at the top of my list, I think this is the role of Marc Maron's career. I think he's fantastic as Sam Sylvia.
You're a lot more familiar with Marc Maron than I am. You listen to his podcast regularly, correct?
Fairly regularly.
Did he have much acting experience prior to this?
He's done bit roles here and there, but he's not a trained actor.
He's a stand-up guy.
Yeah, and he kind of talked about this. He did a show recently with Alison Brie and Betty Gilpin, who are Liberty Bell and – well, Ruth and Debbie.
Debbie Egan and Ruth, yes.
Yes. That is really complicated that we have – the actor, the actress's names, their fictional name on the show, and their character's names.
Yeah,
which there's like 14 women times three different identities.
Man, welcome to pro wrestling. You of all people should know and understand this and be able to deal with this.
But not for everyone. Like Vince McMahon is Vince McMahon on all platforms. Seth Rollins, we're never going to be referring to him as his real name.
All right.
But this, I mean, there's times we're talking about the actress Alison Brie describing a scene involving Ruth Wilder versus another scene as Zora the Destroyer.
I think we'll do our best to navigate through that.
So
standouts for you.
Sam Sylvia is at the top. I thought this guy was outstanding. Yeah. And we talked a bit about this on The Lost Sunday, the fact that it is a blown up version of Marc Maron himself. This is a guy who he made his career off of the fact that he reached a point in his career of frustration, of just no breaks coming his way and just letting it loose on his podcast. Mm-hmm. And now he is enjoying the greatest success of his career. A guy that came up through the comedy scene in California. Of course, he's the host of the WTF podcast. And this role is just, to me, such a natural. I didn't watch a lot of his Marin show, but this to me is, this is just excellent. I thought he played this role perfectly.
He was very good. Perfectly cast. Yes.
And you can certainly make the connections to Matt Simber, who is somebody that was, you know, a director that made a lot of shitty films out there. Also made some very good films as well. He was an award-winning director.
Marin, I listened to an interview about him talking about Glow, and he mentioned basing his character and doing research based off of one of the people that were actually involved in Glow, who I could only assume to be Matt Simber.
It had to have been.
So I would say his character is probably directly based on him, or at least elements of him. My standouts, aside from the leads in Alison Brie and Marc Maron, I thought Betty Gilpin was fantastic as Debbie Egan, Liberty Bell. I think she probably was tasked to play the character with, like, the most range, you know what I mean? The most emotional circumstances, being, you know, catching her best friend cheating on her husband.
That's a great reveal early on when Ruth is going through the bag.
Yes. So I thought she was excellent. My standout, though, person who stole the show for me, was Awesome Kong.
She's awesome.
I thought she was fantastic. Like, I don't know how much she had acted prior to this. I don't know if she had any.
I don't think any.
Acting credits. I'm on her IMDb right now. I see nothing. So, oh, wait a second. Okay. All her IMDb credits are like pro wrestling things. So, let me see here. Impact WWE. Yeah, like, as far as I know, she hasn't done any real acting. And here, you wouldn't be able to tell because she came across so incredibly natural. Everything she was doing on screen captivated me. I thought she showed just incredible charisma that I don't know, it was a side of her that I never saw in her pro wrestling days.
I would argue she was my number two on this. And the two non, like, classically trained actors or actresses to me were the best role. I thought Alison Brie was phenomenal in this. She'd probably be my third on my list of the ones that left the biggest impression at the end of this. Kia Stevens was a breakout star.
Yeah.
And the fact that she also had to play somebody that has no idea what she's doing in a ring.
I thought that was the funniest thing, to see Awesome Kong do a front role for the first time and acting like she didn't know what she was doing. I thought it was hilarious. And I'm sure it was one of the intended things that the editors and producers did was to put the most experienced person in there as one of the people who didn't know how to do that front flip properly. But yeah, I thought she was great, and not at all due to her wrestling. She showcased really very little of her wrestling ability, and it was all her acting that I think, for me, impressed me the most.
Some of the I thought Sam was probably the most quotable character throughout the series. Some of the lines he had when he's, like, describing Ruth as, like, the heel. Her hair is brown, the color of shit. It's just, like, that line. You had Sam pitching to the KDTV executives on Glow. Porn you can watch with your kids. Finally.
Really interesting to think about the writing of those lines from the writers. And I would assume that the writers themselves, or maybe they were wrestling fans growing up, but I would assume that they probably did most of their research after discovering the Glow documentary on Netflix. And for them to kind of have that, like, real strong grasp of what is interesting about pro wrestling, I thought they really hit it.
I thought it was a refreshing look at pro wrestling and not being so, like, one of the complications, I think, with, I don't want to paintbrush, but I'm going to paintbrush, that a lot of modern wrestling is you overlook it so much. The WWE, they run from pro wrestling and have their own vision of what it is. And to me, this is just a refreshing look that it is taking stereotypes, exaggerating them to a 12, and forcing your audience to confront these stereotypes and have some kind of opinion on them. I think this one was much more heavy-handed in that sense than the actual Glow series was. I think the Glow one was largely just lowest common denominator presentation of characters and using racism and sexism to find an audience.
I felt this was that too, except
I think they debate that in
the
show.
The story is, you know, the behind the scenes thought processes of creating that. It's
like
it's
the welfare queen.
Yeah.
And she confronts Sam about this. He's like, is this offensive? And he explains it's a commentary on a social stereotype,
right,
which might have been total bullshit because Sam is just like, he's the used car salesman character here that's just out to produce this show to finance his next film.
I think pro wrestling, you know, for a long, long time has been looked at this, you know, and I think the show confronts that. On the surface, it is this very kind of cheaply produced, soap opera with really heavy-handed stereotypes. But the show investigates that and talks about the depth behind creating characters like that. And so, you know, you even see it today, though, obviously, with Jinder Mahal. I think a lot of people critical of that, but
you think Jinder the Mad Bomber would be in poor taste?
Yes, it would be. It would be in very poor taste.
Isn't like, did you find the portrayal of Beirut the Mad Bomber in this show to be tasteless?
Yes, I did.
See,
fortune cookie?
No, they were all done.
They were tasteless. The characters themselves were tasteless, and they needed to be tasteless in order for the behind the scenes dramatic, I guess, retelling of the production of the story to work. It's poking fun at how ridiculous and tasteless these characters were, and showing the actresses' reactions to playing those stereotypes. So I'm not criticizing the fact that they. I'm saying if Beirut was a character in the WWE today.
Exactly.
Yes, 100% it would be really corny and offensive.
It would be offensive. And this was almost like this show
was an explanation of why.
It was a justification of ridiculous stereotype characters. And is there a value to them?
Yeah. But it also.
Because
though,
it confronts it. It is poking fun at this awful stereotype that exists.
But also, this was the 80s. And not for a second do I think that some of these characters would fly today. You know what I mean? I think the 80s were a different time. But I feel like pro wrestling tastes have greatly, I guess, evolved to the point now where nobody would accept a Liberty Bell as a clear-cut baby face. In fact, she'd probably be booed.
I wanted to chat about some of the other characters in here. I guess the key one first, we should talk about the relationship of Ruth and Debbie, because that is our Hogan Piper.
Yes.
If Piper had slept with Linda Bolea.
Actually, you're Savage Hogan.
Okay. Maybe that's a better parallel. Sure. Had Hogan and Elizabeth got together, as Savage would have probably been paranoid about in the 80s and locking her in locker rooms. They start off, they are the best of friends, and that's our conflict throughout the whole thing, because we find out early on Ruth is having an affair with a married man, Mark, who was also in Mad Men with Alison Brie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She was Trudy Campbell, and he was Harry Crane, another series I watched. Anyway, so
– he was also in The Office.
Like he was, yes. Yeah, yes. He's in Love as well.
Oh.
Have you watched that show, Love?
Yeah, I saw one or two episodes.
I thought you would like it. Maybe not. No, it's not your style. But we talked about the reveal earlier. I thought this was great because I didn't see it coming.
Yeah, it was really good, yes.
And it sets up the perfect conflict for the whole series.
It is revealed. So, what is it? Ruth and Debbie are hanging out in the car, and then
Ruth is a struggling actress.
Yep.
Betty is on Debbie. Debbie
was had a larger role
on a
soap opera, but that role really just consisted of her being in a coma. Then she left the show, or I guess got fired from the show, and ended up being pregnant, left the industry. Anyway, so they're in the car, they're friends, and then it is revealed from one of Debbie's keychains or something like that that it is actually her husband who Ruth has been sleeping with, and you end the first episode that way. I thought that was a great reveal too. I'll say though, for somebody who was in the lead role in Ruth, I felt doing something like that made her incredibly unlikable.
Yes.
And I feel like it needed almost some justification about why she did it. You know what I mean? Just to even see her in the moment getting too drunk, getting too out of hand, especially sleeping with the guy a second time when she was completely sober. I almost felt like for quote unquote a lead baby face in the show, it was almost like too much for somebody to get over. So that even by the end, it's kind of, I could see some people not even liking her even in the end.
So that's why I really kind of like the progress of this, because the relationship Ruth has with Sam, I thought they had some of the best scenes of the entire show. Mm-hmm. There is the one scene in the car where Sam just flat out asks her, why did you sleep with your best friend's husband?
Is that something you fancy?
All right, okay. Shut up.
You're fucking her.
You fucked what's his name?
He wasn't my boss.
Right. He was your best friend's husband. Sorry. That was defensive. I'm sorry. I have a flaw in my conflict style, according to my ex-wife's cognitive behavioral therapist. Why did you do it?
Why does anyone make a stupid, horrible mistake?
Well, for me, it's usually because I'm high or drunk or someone has done something to make me feel so small and so insecure that I have to do something to remind myself that I exist. But you don't seem like that kind of person.
What kind of person do I seem like?
An okay person.
And Sam starts talking about his own history of all these awful mistakes he's made. And he states that he would purposely commit mistakes in his life just so he could feel alive, because he's so insecure and feels little in the world, which Ruth is kind of, that's how she's introduced to us. Mm-hmm. She's a struggling actress that can't get ahead anywhere. Mm-hmm. She's can't even pay her rent.
Yeah.
She's mooching off of her parents to pay her $200 electricity bill. And you see this throughout. And then you get to the abortion episode, which to me was the best episode of the whole series. And that's,
there's also a scene where they're at the Nancy Reagan drug awareness fundraiser.
Yes.
Where Ruth has to give a speech about make up a speech about where she was at when she used to be on drugs, you know.
Yeah, they have to come in to raise money fictitiously.
So they all make up stories about how they are reformed drug addicts who have trained to become wrestlers in order to beg for money. And Ruth gets into her story about how when she was a drug addict, the worst thing she did was she cheated. She slept with her best friend's husband. And obviously in this moment was essentially kind of admitting her guilt and apologizing and talking about how, you know, maybe I did it because I was somewhat, I guess, jealous of my, of her success. It all made sense. I feel like it was still such a despicable act that it was hard for her to redeem her character. You're sleeping with your friend's husband.
I think that it made Ruth like, I like the fact that it was this very complex character. She was the complete antithesis of Liberty Bell, the perfect American babyface, for lack of a better term. And kind of the sub theme throughout Ruth's whole journey on this show is that they can't find a character for her. Sam continually says, I don't know who you are.
Yeah.
And finally, she ends up in this role as this Russian. But like throughout, she's going through all these different characters. And one of the episodes just ends with, I don't know who you are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of like the merging of
this. I guarantee you a lot of current wrestlers probably really identify with a scene like that and a character like that. Imagine all the people down in the Performance Center who are struggling to find those characters. A lot of people on the main roster that are struggling to find their characters, probably having to go through multiple iterations of, you know, failed gimmicks and whatnot until they're able to catch something on, like Ruth has. So I'm sure it was a really identifiable scene with a lot of wrestlers.
And it got deep into wrestling psychology as well, where it's sure. They use Alex Riley as kind of this bridge for
– he's the pro who shows Debbie Egan, hey, you can work with somebody that you hate. It's just professional. It's
and
just
it adds
business.
A level of realism to it because mm-hmm. there is those real feelings that you bring in that the audience can – latch onto, that they can detect over something that is just too manufactured and forced.
The heel makes the face. Rick has been making me look good for years.
That's a good friend.
We're not friends. You don't have to be friends to wrestle. It's like an unspoken language. I look at him like this, he looks at me like that, and we know it's gonna go down. Because that's a partnership, you know? We don't like each other, but we make each other better. Shit in the ring, it's just entertainment. But there's got to be something there that's real. That's what makes it work. That's what makes it hit you.
And it's also Debbie's understanding. It's her eureka moment that wrestling is a soap opera because she very much plays the reluctant participant in all of this.
Yeah.
All of these women are all in on this GLOW project. She is the one that is recruited and brought in. And not into any of this wrestling until she goes.
She thinks it's stupid.
Yes. Yeah. And that kind of continues with Mark's side of things as well, as he remains in that, like looking down on her entire career.
Mark.
Yeah, let's chat about Mark.
The husband.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
What did you.
He's despicable.
What did you think of the dinner scene? It was the most uncomfortable scene.
Which dinner scene?
The one where. So Mark is the husband of Debbie. They have a child together.
Yeah.
And when Debbie finds out about the affair, he is kicked out of the house. And then he serves her with divorce papers, takes it back, and then tries to repair the relationship. And it leads to Debbie agreeing to have dinner with him. And they're sitting at the table, and it is so uncomfortably awful. It's just two people that are so –
oh, it's a failed marriage.
It's a failed marriage.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And Mark explains that there was a period of 42 days where you didn't even touch me or even ask how my day went.
Right.
And again, it's to the same scene like Ruth about just committing a mistake to feel alive.
I still don't think that's any justification for sleeping with your best friend, your wife's best friend.
It's not, but they present his point of view.
I know. I just don't think it's any defense. You know what I mean? By the end of it, I still thought Ruth and Mark ended up being seen as almost too villainous. And in the end, I didn't think they were redeemed.
No. And at the end, there's the scene that it culminates in the big first show where Mark is there and he just thinks this is a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And Debbie has bought into all of this stuff, and he's kind of left as the guy that just – it makes you question, what is this guy trying to preserve? He hates this woman's profession and all that she does. He's cheated on her, but it's all he's got.
Status.
Yeah.
I guess.
That's it.
Anyway, but the fact that we're even having these conversations shows the depth of some of these characters and how interesting they all are. What were some of
I want to have this Miz and Maurice same kind of discussion.
Wow.
Maybe that's where this whole storyline's going.
So who would the Miz sleep with?
It would
have to be Maurice's best friend, who is
Kelly Kelly.
Kelly Kelly.
They just set it up on table for three.
Ouch.
Man, Sheldon Soray will get involved with a hockey stick.
Did you find it interesting that maybe this was a commentary from the writers that, they presented pro wrestling as a very male-oriented soap opera, which is, I guess, how people describe it. But in doing so, they instill one of the most soap operatic cliches in having a woman's a woman's husband sleep with her best friend. So this show in itself really played out like a soap opera.
Yeah, it did. And it was kind of – I mean – when you look at kind of the
show itself could have been just a really straight up behind the scenes retelling of the GLOW formation of struggling female actors getting together to try to learn how to do professional wrestling. It would have been a straight story, but to add, I guess, the panache into it, injecting all these kind of, I guess you can look at it like they're trashy things, like a woman cheating on his wife or a dude with a drug problem.
Yeah, I lost my train of thought there, but now I've got it. And you set it up perfectly because I thought one of the best scenes in terms of explaining this whole thing was when they're at the Nancy Reagan War Against Drugs fundraiser, mm-hmm. and Sam is with these guys and they end up doing blow together. And throughout the show, you hear Sam mentioning this project that he wants to fund if Glow is a success, called Mothers and Lovers. And it's like, here's this guy who largely portrayed as this hack director that just will
who makes maybe cult favorite B movies that
the mainstream looks at as just shit.
Yes.
And he's high on cocaine, explaining the concept.
I've been working on it for like 10 years, man. 10 years. It's a semi-autobiographical psychosexual time travel drama.
What does that mean?
All right, I'll tell you. It's about a boy. It's an all-American kid. Can't stop jerking off to fantasies about having sex with his mother. Right, so it makes him hate himself, right? So he builds a time machine to go into the future where she's old and hideous so he can escape his Oedipal impulses. But, all right, here's the but. He puts the wrong date in the machine and he goes back in time instead to the 1950s where she's just a horny teenager and she spends the rest of the movie just trying to fuck him instead of his dad.
Look, I've seen that movie.
No, you haven't. I haven't made it. It's called Mothers and Lovers.
Nah, bro. It's called Back to the Future.
And to me, it's like the deeper side of it that in pro wrestling, you can have the shittiest premise, and if the execution is done in a certain way, like the way he sets up Mothers and Lovers, it sounds like the most
worst thing in the world.
The lowest common denominator film possible. Mm-hmm. But then when they point out Back to the Future, this classic movie.
It's true.
It's very totally true. Pro wrestling.
Yeah.
Which is, you could take the original Glow and it's trashy and it's the same low rent stereotypes and humor. And yet this series mm-hmm. is critically acclaimed.
100%. Yeah, that's a great point. You could take a woman cheating on her husband, a husband cheating on her wife, on his wife as a pro wrestling storyline. It might be the trashiest, shittiest thing in the world, but presented on a well produced show like this, it can be considered art.
Some other scenes. Whenever Sam and Ruth were in the car, it was great. I thought one of the another scene I really enjoyed was on their way to the abortion clinic.
Yeah.
Because Ruth finds out she is pregnant, obviously, with Mark's child. So mm-hmm. just as the ice is thawing and Debbie and Ruth are begrudgingly working together and finding some common ground for the good of the show, this comes. And this could be the next shoe to drop in this fractured relationship. So Ruth decides to go get an abortion and Sam is taking Ruth to the abortion clinic. So again, you have this relationship. The only person that she's going to confide in about this is Sam. Mm-hmm. And he does the only kind of reaction he can possibly do, which is just to turn it into dark comedy.
I'll probably go get donuts while you're in there.
Pick me up a pink frosted.
Pink frosted? What are you, six?
I like pink things.
Mmm. If you'd liked pink things a little less, maybe we wouldn't be here right now. I feel like I'm supposed to ask you if this is what you want. I mean, you know, as your husband.
Yeah. It's not the right time. Not the right baby. Ruth Wilder?
Fuck. That was quick.
Don't come back without donuts.
I think I'll wait. You can pick them out yourself.
In Soviet Union, abortion is the only thing there's no line for.
And it culminates in Ruth making an abortion joke in her Russian accent to kind of just, that's their only way to explain this horrific experience that a woman has to go through. And I thought that, I loved that episode. I thought that was fantastic with everything involved with Ruth and Sam in that episode. And I think that kind of was that episode kind of just, because you're right, Ruth is presented as kind of this person that fucked up this friendship that I think even if you were very much against her and how she screwed up this friendship, you have some sympathy with her by the end of this and her own torture she has gone through.
Yes, yes, no doubt. Some of my favorite scenes in the show were...
Can I say how impressed you I am that you don't even have notes here, and I'm heavily reliant on mine.
I think if you didn't have notes, you'd do just fine. Yeah. It's just, and you're steering the ship here, so you probably need the notes more than me. But some of my favorite scenes were them cutting promos under their characters for the first time. And let me just say, aside from the welfare queen, I think the, what is it? Okay, let me see this.
I have all the list, the characters listed here. Do you want to run through them here? Zoya the Destroyer, or was it Zora?
Zoya.
I haven't read wrong.
The Beatdown Biddies.
Yes.
Were my absolute favorite. And they're very much
your favorite.
Oh, I thought they were so funny. They were based off of, I'm sure heavily off of actual GLOW characters.
Yes.
The Housewives?
Yes.
Is that who they were called? They're just fantastic.
Yeah. You also had some others we can go here. Sheila the She-Wolf. She's kind of this weird sub-character unto her own.
I did not like her nor her scenes at all. Her whole thing was like, yeah, here's a weirdo who really kind of believes in her character and came in already with this character established. And I think they were trying to show her having kind of like a bit of an identity crisis from birth. You know, she had always – or at least from 5 years, she truly identifies herself as a wolf. I guess looking back now, I suppose maybe there's some commentary to be said from a character like that. What do you think the writers base something like Sheila the She-Wolf off of in real life?
I think they just took her and she was this epitome of a caricature at the beginning. And once they kind of fleshed it out, there are a lot of characters that I hope there are more seasons that you can go a lot deeper with some of these characters, mm-hmm. her being one of them. But you kind of get the sense by the end of it that here's this woman that is just isolated from everybody and she's got this, identity crisis. And she's just kind of totally isolated from the world. And that's what I liked as well about that one episode, the abortion episode. The A and B stories are just completely contrasting, that you have an abortion juxtaposed with this birthday party, mm-hmm. and kind of Ruth going between both.
Right. This very happy setting and then maybe one of the darkest things that somebody could go through.
Yeah, like Ruth is finding out she's pregnant and probably realizing what the next step is in the bathroom as they're all getting excited for this birthday party. Mm-hmm. We should chat about Fortune Cookie.
Sure.
Yeah. Jenny, who did not have a giant role in this series. I would say of all the women, I mean, she was one that I don't think was...
No, she had a smaller role.
She had a small role.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, like, outside of Beirut, probably I won't say that. No, there were a lot of, like, heavily stereotypical characters. But Jenny is a woman from Cambodia that comes over.
Who Ellen is actually from Cambodia.
Is she?
She's actually Cambodian,
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
We should explain that we went to school with Ellen. She was in our year at Ryerson.
Mm-hmm.
So she comes over and she's essentially just intoxicated with American culture. Mm-hmm. And she is the one that spearheads the birthday party. And she's presented with...
That was her biggest role on the show.
Yeah, yes. I would say so. And I think it is another one of those characters that you could definitely see more developed with if there are further... Like, there were a lot of characters on this and there's just not enough...
But with her and with Beirut, I think they fulfilled roles of, you know, playing the token, I guess, minorities in the cast and having to play those very stereotypical roles. But seeing kind of the actual performers' reactions to having to play those roles.
Yeah, they're both kind of offended by it, as is Tammy, the welfare queen.
Yeah, the most notable one, though, was Beirut in the final episode where she performs as Beirut, what is her, the bomber?
The
mad bomber. And here you see her perform as her heel terrorist character, and the fans in the crowd are spitting at her, throwing beer cans, and she is actually
quite
shocked by it. And I suppose that was done to show that, you know, pro wrestling really seems to bring out, at least at the time, and I would say even today, I mean, look at Jinder Mahal and the reactions he gets at some places. It really seems to bring out, like, a really ugly, racist parts of a lot of people.
Right? Yeah, and they go through this transition in the third episode where Sam has written the draft for the first, and it's fucked. It's like totally, it's set up with terms like cuntar, the uterus wall.
It's one of his kind of stereotypical off the wall space sex, you know, B movie scripts.
Yes. Yeah, and then after going to this Malibu party that Sebastian, who's his mother is bankrolling this whole thing, that's kind of the epiphany where they are just, they don't want to dance around stereotypes. They want to just see that line and sprint past it and make it as stereotypical as possible. Beirut, here's a gun. Just everything to amplify these stereotypes to their largest and most impactful interpretation.
Yeah.
And that's how they find out the direction for GLOW.
Do you think that pro wrestling needs to be that? Because I think some old school wrestling fans and maybe even some new school wrestling fans would argue that you have to devolve to base stereotypes to get people over. We see it right now in 205 Live where a lot of those characters are very much one dimensional, and they're probably one dimensional for a reason, because they're unknowns to a large part of that demographic. Is that the only way, or have we evolved past that as wrestling fans?
I feel that, you know, what made the idea of a wrestling promotion featuring these characters as just these characters.
Yeah.
I think that would be very lame in 2017.
Unless it was all done very tongue in cheek, like it was presented on this show.
Even that, I think that would have a very short shelf life to it. I think there would be some novelty in it because it would be such a throwback to the original GLOW series.
Like WrestleLicious was, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. But not any kind of – like the value of this show are the people playing these roles and the storytelling behind them. Mm-hmm. And I think in today's pro wrestling environment, it's great to have effective gimmicks, but you need personalities and characters behind them. Yeah. And that's why you will – John Cena doesn't have a gimmick per se.
He used to.
He did. And that was a great introduction. Yeah. But the John Cena as just that one-dimensional rapper had 2 to 3 years in it.
Certainly. You look at the landscape of, the WWE right now, and you'd be hard-pressed to find, you know, a one-sentence definable main eventer. What's Randy Orton? I can't really tell you in one sentence. What's Roman Reigns? I can't really tell you in one sentence. Seth Rollins, AJ Styles, none of these guys are stereotypes anymore. But I guess in the 80s, that was kind of what worked for the company.
Some of the wrestlers that were featured in this, there were a number of cameos.
Number of cameos,
through.
Yeah.
The strangest one being John Hennigan, Johnny Mundo, as Salty the Sack Johnson, the trainer in episode 1, who disappears after episode 1. He's fired and then never heard from again.
I'm curious to know what was behind that, because he didn't really get like a notable dismissal or anything. It was just like he was there.
It's written off.
It was just written off. And but I had to – you have to wonder that, like – because that trainer as well ended up going to Cherry, Junk Chain.
Yes. Cherry Bang.
Cherry Bang. And so – you would assume that was always a part of the script, but I thought John Hennigan's dismissal was rather kind of like ignored, like rather abruptly.
He's never referenced again. And I mean, yeah, there didn't seem to be any value in a return from this character down the road. I almost wonder why he was included. Like, it could be one thing if they shot the scene with the intent of using him. Mm-hmm. It just seemed afterwards that this was something that, I don't know if he wasn't available. I don't know if it was just intentional to be there one episode.
I'll also say, like, I'm sure John Hennigan is probably a decent actor these days. I haven't seen a lot of his recent work, but he didn't really exactly impress me nor stand out in this show. I would have actually loved to have seen Chavo try that role, who trained a lot of these wrestlers.
Yeah, Chavo was the one. All these women went through 4.5 weeks of wrestling training. Mm-hmm. Kia Stevens also assisted in the training as well. So, I mean, there was – like the actual making of this show, there were a lot of parallels you were watching on screen of these women that came in not knowing what this was and having to learn from scratch.
I think that's definitely one of the brilliant parts of this concept, is that here are actresses from Hollywood who know nothing about wrestling. Here's Marc Maron himself, who admittedly knew nothing about wrestling before taking this role, and they had to play characters who exactly had to figure that out for themselves while they were learning at the same time. So a lot of that I thought played out very naturally. Like some of my favorite scenes, again, were watching these women try to take front bumps for the first time and looking terrible. Try and cross bodies for the first time and looking terrible at it. And that's all because they probably were terrible at it. And, you know, I thought that really worked out.
Beyond that, they do the scene where they take Debbie to the bed. I keep screwing up Debbie and Betty with which her
the same person.
Anyway, same thing where they take her to the wrestling match, and that's kind of where it's where she's introduced to Alex Riley, who plays Steel Horse.
Well, I think does a great job.
He was very good in the one episode he's in. I thought he was going to have more than just the one episode, but he might
come back next season.
He could. He was open. You had him in a match with Joey Ryan, who played Mr. Monopoly. If legally he can, I think he could take that role and play it outside of the Glow universe.
Kaz and Daniels also make an appearance.
And that scene was shot in Reseda, where PWG does their shows in California.
But going back to Alex Riley, I listened to an interview he did recently, and apparently he got that role only like about three or four months maybe following his dismissal from the WWE.
Wow.
And I thought he did a great job, you know. And I would say, like, we actually talked about him last week or 2 weeks ago on Money in the Bank in our review. We kind of had like a mini assessment of him.
Oh, that's right.
You were asking me, you know, my thoughts on him. And I thought he probably came to wrestling maybe at a time that was – not exactly the greatest for him, because tastes had by now have shifted, you know, to more smaller men who are actually very a lot more physically, I guess, better wrestlers than he is. But I'll say, like, in acting, I think he could actually do really well, and especially judging by a performance like this, he seemed perfect for the part of this kind of big stereotypical, you know, big wrestler, very handsome, good-looking baby face who could act. I actually thought he was very convincing.
And he was doing really well, I felt, as a color commentator in NXT, and then he wanted to go back to wrestling. And that kind of, you know, a lot of circumstances occurred with Corey Graves having to retire that opened it up for Graves to get onto the commentary desk. So it was kind of this weird domino effect. Also featured, we had the Lumber Jacksons, which we had Carmen, who is the one that comes from a wrestling family.
Who I would say her character is maybe based on Mount Fuji,
yes.
From the actual Glow series.
Yes. I think everyone, would connect those two characters together. So her father is a pro wrestler. Her brothers, who are played by Tyrus and Carlito, as the Lumber Jacksons, are also wrestlers, and she has to kind of follow in the family footsteps and ends up having to – she has stage fright for her first match. She can't even go into the ring.
Tyrus, Brodus Clay, former Brodus Clay, and Carlito, I wouldn't picture the two being siblings, but when you see them together on the show, I could buy it. I could buy it.
There was also a brief cameo as Sam and Ruth go to scout a venue. And they get to the venue.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about this cameo.
And our person here to show us the venue is Brooke Hogan, of all people.
Of all people.
Out of nowhere. I had to rewind. I was like, wait a minute.
Is that Brooke Hogan?
That was the most random one of the
whole
show.
It was very random. I thought she did a good job, though. She was convincing to me. Like, I'll say, you know, if I could tell somebody's acting, that's when I get lifted out of the scene. But I thought she played the part of like an 80s, you know.
She had the hair for it.
She definitely had the hair. She had the look for it. I thought she did well.
I loved when they're going to the arena to check it out, Sam wants Ruth to come. And Ruth is honored that she can have a say in this whole thing. And he goes, you won't have a say. I just need someone to disagree so I can clarify my own instincts, which I just thought was a great line. And then the one other character.
Marin, like, delivers those lines perfectly.
Oh, he was.
That cocky, kind of like sarcastic delivery, I think he nails, yes.
He's great. Mm-hmm. The other, like, really featured character who is kind of just a role player early on, but then becomes a big focus, is Justine, who's just. She is Dean Ambrose throughout most of it.
Yeah, the British girl.
No.
Oh, sorry. Yes, the
Justine
daughter.
Justine is the punk.
The daughter, yes.
Yeah. But we'll talk about Britannica
as
well.
She is the Dean Ambrose. How so?
I mean, just if you were to think of a female Dean Ambrose, I think that's who we would come up with.
She is kind of like the quiet emo punk rocker.
Yeah. So I mean, the most we learn about her early is she has a thing for this pizza delivery guy. And
at one point she steals Marin's camera.
Yeah.
And
which is a no-no in your line of work.
Big no-no. And then intends to frame Britannica, who is, of course, involved in a relationship with Marin.
So it makes sense at the end, but yeah. She's got this weird, she is the one that comes in that's a big fan of Sam Sylvia's work. She's into his films, even to a point when she's with the pizza guy and he's dismissing him as this hack, and she gets very defensive of him and is dismissive of Sam's relationship with Rhonda, who's one of the women wrestlers that he's having an open affair with. And it culminates in the same Nancy Reagan drug party, anti-drug party, where Sam has been –
it was a drug party for him.
Yeah. So after his Mothers and Lovers script is just thrown at him as a Back to the Future knockoff, he's in this room and Justine comes in, and it ends up with Sam, who's high at this point, who makes a move on her, and she just immediately reacts and gets back and is disgusted and reveals that she is Sam's daughter in one of the most weirdest scenes, but also like the most perfect scene for this Sam Sylvia character to find out he has a daughter.
There you go. Another soap operatic cliche injected into this show that is somewhat critical and almost satirizing a male soap opera. I almost feel like at this point it has to be intentional to include all these, you know, wild off the wall, very over the top reveals. I cheated on your husband with whatever. I keep getting that mixed. I'm your daughter in the middle of the season. It's amusing. And I think you have to watch it, with that mindset that perhaps this is, I guess almost a commentary about like how ridiculous, shit can be in not just soap operas or pro wrestling, but actual Netflix shows. They're just as ridiculous as wrestling.
It gets even more ridiculous the next day when he's gone on this bender and he finds Justine with the pizza guy in his house and is explaining, I never would have done that if I knew you were my daughter. And it's just like the creepiest, weirdest speech.
Yeah, but he's so honest about it.
Oh, it was
that you can't help but like him.
Oh, you know? To me, it was like the Sam Sylvia character was the most fascinating.
I'm curious to know how much of the actual what's his name, the actual producer, the director from GLOW, what's his name,
Matt Simber.
I'm curious to know how much of him is in that character.
I don't know. I don't know a whole lot about Matt Simber, but he's like a guy in his mid-80s that I
Marin, though, in an interview, he said that in doing the research, he discovered that the person he was to play also had drug issues. So I'd like to know, you know, how much of his portrayal is based off of him. But certainly it feels like a character very natural to Marin himself.
Yeah. I mean, Matt Simber, there's not a whole lot out there on him. So I'd be curious how much he researched, because Matt Simber wouldn't be interviewed for the Globe. Right. He appears in it, but he wouldn't be interviewed for it.
Can we also talk about Bash?
Yeah.
And how he seems to be maybe a rich version of David McClane. David McClane in the way that, you know,
he felt very Eric Bischoff.
Yeah.
David McClane.
He's a young man who is incredibly passionate and enthusiastic about pro wrestling. Probably had the vision for, I guess, the over the top campy, you know, direction of GLOW.
Yep.
But I would say that it never really completely clicked for me that this guy was playing David McClane until he started to do the announcing in the final episode, where he does a fucking dead-on David McClane impression as he's calling the matches. And at that point, I'm like, oh, he's playing David McClane. It clicked.
Yeah, you know? And it's been interesting to read. I read so many of the reviews and interviews that were done that you do get a sense that they want to have a comfortable distance from the original GLOW. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not shy about saying, like, that was the inspiration, but we're very much creating our own world and away from this. Matt Simber said, like, even though they Netflix got the, because one of the female wrestlers actually bought the trademark back in 2001. So he's not disputing that they have the trademark for GLOW, but was insinuating that there were certain, there might have been some possible infringements as well. That, who knows how legitimate Simber's gripes are, but I'm curious what the reaction is to a lot of the women and even some of the creators of the original Glow of this, because this is going to be a gigantic success, and it's interesting to see how the show producers are kind of trying to make it separate from the original Glow.
If you're actually, you know, one of the original cast members from the original real life Glow, I can't see you taking too much issue with what's being portrayed here, because this is an over the top dramatized version of, you know, I wouldn't look at this like a documentary, and nobody should. This is a
But if anyone will be, it will be people that were directly involved. That's what you will default to. And
but I'll say, like, in watching the documentary, some of the things that were similar was the fact that they
did you watch the documentary beforehand?
Yeah. I watched a little bit of it after watching this.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's been a couple of years since we watched.
Would like to go back and rewatch it.
But they did in fact all decide to move all the wrestlers into first. I think it was the Riviera.
Yep.
They told them to all get rid of your apartments and move into this Las Vegas hotel where you can all live together to kind of foster this relationship. I think, you know, they really hit on, I guess, the sisterhood and the camaraderie that the wrestlers built together. And that was something that was mentioned in the documentary as well. The fact that upon entering this casting call, a third of the participants decided to just leave when they discovered that it was wrestling was also replicated in the movie, in the Netflix series. And that is, I guess, concurrent with, some of the recounting of what actually happened.
Cause at this casting call, Sam brings in all these actresses and he sells it as this is tit grabs and cunt punches. That's how he sells this. And it just clears out the room pretty dramatically at the start.
Yeah. Did you also notice any other kind of characters that were drawn from the original Glow?
I mean, I think that you could look at Cherry Bang a little bit, like Big Mama, who was kind of, you know, kind of like the mother of these of all the participants involved. Right. I mean, she was one of the wrestlers, but also, I mean, she was put into the position of power amongst the women and kind of Sam's like left hand or right hand woman.
Enforce curfew, things like that.
Yeah, all of that stuff. They even talk about, it's really brief, a back history with Sam, Cherry, and Cherry's husband, having a random three-way years ago when they worked on a movie together.
Hmm.
Which is kind of just weird. To me, it really didn't
fit. There were a lot of things that I felt were a little out of nowhere throughout the course of the show.
The miscarriage scene? Did that work?
I thought that... Oh, her miscarriage scene. I don't know.
The one with the ketchup.
Yeah. Some of that stuff I don't really know, because, like, I don't know how much it affected the overall story, at least, like, for the amount of time that it was given on screen. I don't know how much it played into the narrative of overall. And there are a few instances like that I'll have to kind of watch back. But at points, it felt a little disjointed and not as maybe as smooth of a one single story as maybe you might necessarily expect. There seemed to be a lot of asides.
Yeah. If anything, I mean, that they bring up the fact that Cherry had a miscarriage, and Melrose, who's kind of like the bratty chick, for lack of a better term, on the show.
Yeah. She's the Jewish American princess.
So she does a scene where she pretends she's having a miscarriage while they're training with like ketchup disguised as blood. And I mean, for that, you go, it's almost, they never really address this issue with Cherry ahead of time, but they have, here's a woman who had a miscarriage, and then later you have a woman who needs an abortion.
Right.
But that
connection was never really,
that was never made. But I mean, these are all things that, I mean, could be revisited.
I wonder how much of it is, you know, including the stuff with the She-Wolf girl. I wonder how much of it is just the writer's intent to kind of flesh out the characters for every, what is it, 14 of the.
I was glad they didn't go overboard and try to heavily define all of them, because you didn't have 10 episodes with 14 women.
I know.
You had to pick who were the keys.
I almost thought they kind of did, though, almost give you a little too much backstory for a lot of them. You know, but that said, even though I wouldn't say this show is, like, you know, the best produced show, or it's very well produced, I wouldn't say it's the best written show. I thought the world that they created was incredibly fun to be in, you know, just to see, to be in the 80s, to see these women with these crazy hairstyles and incredible personalities. All of them are very charismatic. To see them learn about professional wrestling and to, you know, discover a layman's perspective of, you know, finding out the depth of professional wrestling, something that you and I and everybody listening to this show has known, you know, the entire time we've been fans, to see them discover it at the same time, I thought was a lot of fun.
So, I mean, we won't divide or give too much time here to the finale or the final show, but they put on the big show, and the way the series ends, I mean, they've set a lot up for a second season.
Certainly.
And I'd be really shocked if this doesn't get a second season.
Me too.
I mean, the only thing that would prohibit that is if, you know, if there were like what the deals are. Like typically for a show like this, you would hopefully have all of the cast down for several seasons.
Yeah.
You would hope.
They've only got to, I mean, the season ends with the first episode. So you have the entire behind the scenes run of the actual show that you can tell.
Which is a way it could end on its own just like that. But it's easy to just take off from there for season two.
As far as like potential stories they could do, the documentary itself doesn't really focus so much on the creation of GLOW. It focuses on what happened when GLOW ended, you know, the abrupt cancellation and the bond that was cut off between these women upon the cancellation of the show. And that could create for an incredible story for a potential second or even third season for this
series.
It's
also the popularity peak of GLOW when these women become big stars as a result of it. And also it ends where at the end of this first show, Liberty Bell and Ruth are as close as they've been since the breakup.
Yeah.
And you have Ruth just trying to take that one step closer about, do you want to go get a drink? And is immediately cut off and says, no, we're not there yet.
I think our match was good.
I mean, I'm sure I'll hate it when I see it, but it felt good.
Debbie, we were great. You want to grab a drink?
No. We're not there.
Yes.
That was a great way to just end it between those two.
It was good. Before we end off, I want to get your opinion on some of the actual wrestling that was involved. And the wrestling is what it is, okay? Don't watch the show. I mean, I'm sure Chavo did a great job. Don't expect any like great looking moves in this at all.
Ellen did a head scissors.
She did, yeah.
That was the most impressive thing I saw on this show.
I mean, obviously, Awesome Kong did a bunch of, did some cool stuff too. She did a helicopter spin, whatever. But
the quotient of dialogue to wrestling scenes was about perfect on the show.
The big spot was, Liberty Bell doing a crossbody from the top rope.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something she worked on. I love the scene of her training with, Tyrus and, Carlito just to do that crossbody. It was really nice. But, what were your thoughts on the booking of the final match involving Liberty Bell and Zoya the Destroyer with a late run-in from Welfare Queen?
Yeah, they redid WrestleMania 31 with Seth Rollins cashing in.
Oh, okay.
At the end.
I guess that could be it. I think part of it could be seen as like a maybe a slight homage to Montreal and various screw jobs of the past, where the promoter, Mark Maron, last minute decides.
Swerves the two involved.
Yeah.
Only one of both of them, neither was in on it.
But I thought it was brilliant because Maron's last line is, the money's in the chase.
Yes, which is also the episode title of the last one, which is right. Again, it sets up for the actual GLOW production that they're producing. It takes you into another season where it's the Welfare Queen who has the crown.
I'm really curious to know, like, for the writers of the show, who they consulted in professional wrestling, not just from the technical side of things, but I guess like from the behind the scenes perspective. Because like, you know, something like a line like the money's in the chase, that is something I feel like they would have had to do a bit of research, reading, you know, maybe books from former promoters or speaking to former promoters and hearing them talk about it in order for them to kind of, grasp the concept.
I would be very curious about that as well, because I could almost look at it that being the fact that they were several layers removed from the wrestling industry, they were able to see a much broader picture of what they're trying to do and not be so in the weeds as some can be in wrestling, where it's got to be so complex and complicated instead of
pro wrestling is very simple. Yeah. At its basic core, it's very fucking simple.
Don't you think, like, if they booked Welfare Queen to beat Liberty Bell at the end of the TV taping, imagine the outcry from, like, even the internet audience at, you know, this shitty booking. Oh, this show ended so well. How could you have this, you know, out of nowhere, Welfare Queen taking the glow crown from Liberty Bell?
What do you feel is the WWE's response to this series? Because it is, they are getting the attention that WWE salivates over getting.
You're right.
And this, you can compare to what happened when The Wrestler came out, where immediately they decreed the film.
Oh,
they were against it and then ended up getting into bed with Mickey Rourke and endorsing the film.
I'll say The Wrestler is, you know, very much the tone of, you know, like something like Beyond the Mat that you can argue paints a negative light on professional wrestling, or at least highlights a lot of the negative portions of pro wrestling, the drug use, the, I guess, the health issues and the kind of like, father parenting issues that a lot of wrestlers go through. This, on the other hand, I think only highlights the fun parts of professional wrestling.
I think this puts wrestling in a really prestigious light. Beyond just the content of the series, but
as a social commentary.
Pro wrestling is a mainstream topic because of this show.
Yeah.
You have outlets that are looking at pro wrestling without their tongue inserted in their cheek. And to me, it's putting wrestling on a much larger platform than anyone.
I think this show is a fantastic gateway for non-wrestling fans to get into professional wrestling, because it shows you the depth that's involved in being a fan of professional wrestling. It's not just what you see on the TV. It's a lot of what goes into the characters behind the scenes, a lot of what goes into the storylines behind the scenes, a lot of what goes into the in-ring action behind the scenes. So if I was the WWE, I would, they would never praise something that they didn't personally produce. I wonder if they have their, you know, sights set on maybe welcoming some of the stars. If I were them, I'd be trying to get Awesome Kong back into the company at this point, knowing how well she came across.
Oh,
in
I
this
think
show.
At most you could get her for a one-off.
I mean,
I think she's set after this.
But
series.
At this point, like Keith Stevens, I think she could
she's
do a
an
lot.
Actress now.
I think she could do a lot better than, you know, just being Karma in the WWE.
Yeah, I'm not going to compare her to Dave Bautista, but she's at a point she does not need wrestling after this series.
100%. So, but at the same time, for their immediate benefit, this could really play well into the Mae Young Classic that they have coming up. You know, if I was Triple H, I'm certainly looking at this as a positive.
Do you think that there's any possibility of them trying to work with any of the women for like a SummerSlam angle, or to try, even if it is an appearance on it? Like,
they're not wrestlers though. You know, like none of these women are wrestlers.
No, but that hasn't stopped them in the past from using celebrities.
I also don't feel like they're going to get Alison Brie. And I also don't think most of these other women are big enough stars to make a big difference to a SummerSlam audience. You know what I mean?
I don't know.
Maybe Marc Maron you can get, but I don't necessarily see.
See, I think he would be the least transferable to a WWE setting. Like, I could see one of the women being used in a tag match.
I don't think WWE audiences would buy it, because they are still very limited in ring.
It would be a clash of two versions of professional wrestling, that one is a kind of fictionalized drama and the other is an attempt to do professional
Keith
wrestling.
Stevens would be the only person I could see getting the slot like that. But I don't see them acknowledging it really at all. But like I said, you know, if I was Triple H, I would try to parlay the success of this into the Mae Young Classic about, you know, Glow maybe at one time was a really groundbreaking.
They won't go that way.
They really
they
overstate.
They don't own Glow, or else it would be something more.
Right. But I think there's a lot of attention from a female demographic right now on professional wrestling, and I think the Mae Young Classic is something that could capitalize on that to capture that audience.
Well, we've chatted for over an hour here on our thoughts. Was there anything else, any final thoughts you had about the series? I think that hopefully I'd be stunned if there's not a second season out of this. I think that this has been one of the more successful shows that Netflix has launched. I mean, I think it's at 96% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's gotten fairly overwhelmingly positive reviews.
I think it's very well done. A lot of the performances are great. But more so than that, like, I just had fun. I had fun being in this world watching.
What'd you think about the music?
Great. Totally fit.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think they did a good job of not going to too many mainstream 80s hits, you know? Yeah. They seem to go a lot more subtle and a lot more, I guess, obscure, more probably for budgetary reasons as well, but even more obscure than like Guardians of the Galaxy, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought totally worked. The 80s are hot right now, and this show capitalized on that.
Well, do you want to do feedback?
Sure.
All right. We're going to go to the Law message board. We got a bunch of feedback from you as well, for those of you that have watched the show. And let us start off with Elliot, who writes, "The main thing I've seen from watching GLOW is that Lana does a better Russian accent than Alison Brie. And secondly, Alex Riley is as good an actor as he is a wrestler. Love the gym being named Chavos, as the former Los Guerrero member was a trainer on the show. But my show highlight was Awesome Kong versus the KKK. Was, dare I say it, karma overall for the series, and 8 early 80s moonsaults out of 10. That's Elliot from Kent in the UK.
How about that? The Russian accent thing. And I'm sure, like, I'm curious, Lana, the perspective of somebody like Lana watching that scene.
Well, Alison Brie also stated that she specifically didn't work with a dialect coach. She wanted it to be – she just would mimic.
Oh, yeah. It's supposed to sound
– it's supposed to be a bad Russian accent.
Yeah.
So she said very much that I mean, that one, you can definitely get the parallel to Nanochka,
yes,
from GLOW, that she wanted it to be – she didn't want it to be a solid Russian,
yeah,
accent.
Yeah. Also, I mean, it's a throwback to the time with the Cold War and everything. But I think it gives you like new appreciation for Lana and how she – you know, she is somebody who seems to be able to improvise so well in that character with that accent for such a long time. Anyway, we go to our next piece of feedback, Danny, who says, "I enjoyed the series and was able to binge in one sitting as the episodes are only 30 minutes. As a fan of Orange is the New Black, whose characters also created the Netflix GLOW show, I can see in future seasons exploring more of the cast's backstory, like Orange is the New Black. We got a taste in episode 4 with the She-Wolf putting on the wig and eyeliner in the beginning of that episode. Carmen was my favorite character, and I'm sure her Inca character is a Mount Fiji archetype. But to be a TV critic for a second, they did a miscarriage and abortion side plot in episode 2 and 8 that could have touched the subject matter a tad more tastefully."
I thought the abortion stuff, I thought that played in really effectively to Ruth's character. And I thought that scene in the car on their way to the clinic was one of the strongest of the entire. That, to me, encapsulated both their characters and specifically Sam as well during that scene.
Yeah, I thought so too. I thought it served to kind of draw sympathy for Ruth. You know?
Yeah, I think that was definitely the intent. Christian writes, "This show was really easy to watch, and I was rather happy the episodes were only 30 minutes. Felt it pleased us wrestling fans with a lot of the inside references and cameos from wrestlers, but it could grab a general audience as well with the story it told. Also, much like pro wrestling, the characters were meant to hate Ruth, who I actually liked, and the ones we were meant to love in Debbie, I actually found hard to get behind her, at least at first, as by the midway point, I liked both. Sam was probably my favorite character, as he not only had the best jokes, but had so much story to get into. I did think that a lot of the characters didn't get enough at all, but it ended clearly teasing more, so I imagine everyone will get their episode to shine in. There's a lot more story they could tell." Yeah, that definitely left a lot of options, mm-hmm, of different directions you can go for season 2.
We got a John Casey who says, "I wasn't sure what to make of this after the first 2 episodes, but was glad that I stuck through it. However, I can certainly understand if people stop watching, especially after episode 2. I definitely enjoyed both the actual wrestling and the behind the scenes look at how to produce a wrestling show. Unfortunately, from episode 7, I got bored of the characters' private lives, but I'm guessing that was because I binge watched the series. I thought that Mark Maron was brilliant and certainly a revelation, and hopefully he's in future episodes. My favorite scene was definitely the ode to Vince Russo, where in the title match in episode 10, they had a tag match, had a double cross, and then an impromptu title match and title change, only to have another title change when Liberty Bell lost the Wahlberg Queen, who had lost previously on the same show."
We go to John. "I wasn't sure what to make of this after the first 2 episodes, but was glad that I stuck through it. However, I just
did that.
Oh, was that the one?
Yeah.
Sorry. Next one here. As a fan of the original GLOW, I was skeptical, as they had said they would do sort of based and not truly based on the characters. Instead, they took totally new characters, though there are several that have familiarities."
Yeah, this was never meant to be a direct retelling, nor should it have been.
No, that would have
Yeah.
It would have handcuffed them to you know, they're, you can make the connections, but they're very faint.
I wouldn't want to see that at all. I'd want to see their own creations of what these actresses would have done had they been in GLOW at the time.
Yeah. You continue.
Okay. We go to Retro Dreams, who says, "Hey guys, I have to say I really enjoy GLOW. I watched it all in one sitting, but not once did I feel like, fuck, this is boring. The storyline was simple to follow, and never once did you feel like they were trying to insult your intelligence. Seeing cameos by former WWE wrestlers really was a pleasant surprise, and the soundtrack of the show fit perfectly."
Mark writes, "I absolutely adored this series. I binge-watched all 10 episodes in 5-episode sittings in one day." Okay. "My favorite character would have to be Allison Brie as Ruth. Even though Ruth is not perfect and did a very bad thing that would make you hate her, Brie plays the part so well that you can't help but like her, and you can't help but want her to succeed. Mark Maron as Sam is great. I found myself laughing at some of his great lines, and I love this character development throughout the series. Everyone in this show is great, and I would happily recommend the show to anyone. Great production, lovable characters, and it just does wrestling right. Signed, Genji Cohen."
Finally, we got a Vince from Toronto who says, "At the time of posting, I'm 5 or 6 episodes in. I'm finding it hard to get past Mark Maron's Weekend at Bernie's appearance. I keep waiting for Andrew McCarthy to turn him into a human marionette doll. Otherwise, the show is pretty enjoyable on the surface, but deep down, I don't really connect with any of the characters. Most of the central characters are so flawed that I cannot sympathize with them. The one character I connect with is Carmen. She's strong, but kind and good-hearted. It's like she's the only person who's there because she wants to be.
Or because she's on Quaaludes."
Isn't Carmen Machu Picchu?
Remember at the end there?
Oh, right. Yes.
Ruth comes to give her a pep talk before the big show. And then comes back with Quaaludes as her way to deal with her stage fright. All right. Well, thank you, folks, for leaving some feedback. We hope you enjoyed this non-traditional review away. But this was a lot of fun.
It was.
I think we've kind of now mastered the non-wrestling kind of review. This felt much more... It flowed better.
Yeah, and I believe that there is another dramatic wrestling TV show coming out in the near future on Starz, correct? It's called something Heels or something like that. Anyway,
I've not heard of this.
I don't believe it's going to be out for some time, but when that comes out, I look forward to doing that as well. Because, I mean, I think the public at this point is very much aware of what we've been aware for a long time, and it's that, you know, the behind the scenes of pro wrestling is more interesting than what's actually on screen.
So the next review away is going to be coming out in 2 weeks on Friday, July the 14th. And I will not be around that week way. Yeah.
Where are you going?
Surprise. I'm competing in the Mae Young Classic that night.
Oh, you are?
No, good I will luck. Not. But I will not be here that week. So you are going to hold down the fort. And I understand you have enlisted someone in the Law family.
Yeah.
And you are... going with a unique review that week.
Yeah. So with all the talk of Omega, Okada recently and how these two are perhaps on their way of having the greatest wrestling trilogy of all time, I'd like to go back and review what many consider to currently be the greatest wrestling trilogy of all time. And that is, of course, Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat. And the only person I can think of to do that particular review with is... one of my favorite co-hosts when you're away, John, on Review Away. And
Rick
that
Flair?
Is not Ric Flair. It is Dan Lebransky, who
great.
I guess has some association with Ric Flair.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But Dan, of course, I wouldn't look to anybody else for expert opinion of that time, of that era. So I very much look forward to watching those three particular matches and discussing the context of the time and to discuss those actual matches with him.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating time period in NWA, WCW history in 1989. One of the truly great years of in-ring matches that the NWA produced that year, and those were three of the big ones. So enjoy. I will be listening, and that will be out Friday, July the 14th.
Well, on that note, John, if you're going to be away, I think I'm going to be away next week too.
Are you going to leave?
Yeah, I think I'm going to.
Oh.
I'm not going to be around next week either.
Well, Christ, I'm not going to be around either. So who's going to be here on Monday and Tuesday?
Sorry, did we not announce this already or did we?
I think it's been announced on.
Oh, okay,
shows,
okay, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Me and Wei, we're taking a break.
Yeah.
We will be back.
This review took too much out of us.
It was clearly a lot. We felt the glow. And now we are going to reflect.
We're going to be off for a week, and then I'll be back.
Yeah, next week we will have new hosts on Review a Raw and Review a SmackDown. And you can tune in and find out.
Yeah.
Or go seek it out. It's out there. Mm-hmm. And I also want to make mention next Friday, because we do alternate weeks with Keep It 2000. Next week's show, it's Brian Mann and Nate Milton reviewing the April 10th Nitro from 2000, which is the night of the big dramatic reset with Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff. It's the furthest thing from GLOW we could possibly get than the night that Russo and Bischoff return to Nitro. So Keep It 2000 takes it to the next level starting next week with the beginning of the Russo and Bischoff era.
That is perhaps the Netflix show I want the most. Is a retelling of WCW in 2000.
I hope it doesn't break those two. But that is coming up next Friday on liveaudiowrestling.com. So that's going to take us out, and we will chat with you in the future.
Are we sure this is the right channel?
Yes.
Yes.
Are people going to like it?
What if no one watches? What if it turns out we can't wrestle? We only thought we could.
I don't watch.
No. Oh, wait. Ow. It's starting.
Batch Howard Productions and Patio Town Inc. proudly present from the Hayworth Hotel in Los Angeles, California. It's GLOW, the gorgeous ladies of wrestling.